Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be searching for 13th century translator, rhetorician, and poet Brunetto Latini. He was the teacher of Dante. He was the first to translate Aristotle and Cicero into a vernacular language. His translations set the stage for the rhetorical turns in the Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution. He was a poet, and his student Dante in his Divine Comedy damned him to hell. Find out why when we search for Brunetto Latini on Arts and Letters, coming up in the next half hour. For the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts, humanities, and social sciences at ULR. Today, we'll be searching for Brunetto Latini, a 13th century Italian poet, translator, and rhetorician. If he is known at all by American scholars, it is because of his student Dante, who in Canto 15 in the Inferno consigned his teacher Latini to the seventh circle of hell. For a moment, let's return to English class and review what we know about Dante and the Inferno.
Dante Alighieri, moral philosopher, scholar, poet, born in Florence, Italy in 1265, wrote his epic poem as a warning to a corrupt society while in exile from Florence in 1302.
In the Divine Comedy, according to the Biography Channel, Roman poet Virgil guides Dante through hell, the Inferno, and purgatory, Purgatorio, while Beatrice, based on Dante's true love, Beatrice Portinari, guides him through heaven, Paradiso.
The journey lasts from the night before Good Friday to the Wednesday after Easter in the spring of 1300, placing it before Dante's factual exile from Florence, which looms throughout the Inferno and serves as an undercurrent to the poet's journey.
When Dante meets Latini in the seventh circle of hell, he says,
"You were to me in the world when hour by hour you taught me how man makes himself eternal."
To find out more about this enigmatic figure and why Dante put his teacher in hell, we've invited UALR rhetoric and writing professor Dr. Michael Klein, a scholar of classical rhetoric, to discuss his book Searching for Latini, published by Parler Press. Later, we'll hear from Latini scholar Julia Bolton Holloway, and Dr. Klein's daughter, Amy, with whom he stayed during his quest to Florence. Dr. Michael Klein, teacher, scholar, classical rhetorician, welcome.
It's good to be here with all of you, all of the voices, and thanks for contributing to the effort to lift Brunetto, if not out of hell, at least obscurity.
So, Dr. Klein, tell us how you began your search.
Well, while I was visiting my daughter, Amy, who lives in Florence, Italy, I asked a Dante scholar, Massimiliano Chiamenti, we called him Max, thank heavens, who would you say is the most important Italian rhetorician other than those who, like Cicero, spoke and wrote in Latin? Max responded, "That's easy, Brunetto Latini."
You had barely remembered Dante's mention of Brunetto Latini, and given your passion for the study of rhetoric, you wanted to find out more. The more you learned, the more fascinated you became.
Yeah, I found that Brunetto Latini was an incredibly complex figure, the teacher of Dante, as European scholars would have him, but also the translator of both Aristotle and Cicero into the vernacular Italian of his time. He was a poet whose work directly influenced Dante, a brilliant rhetorician whose speaking and writing influenced people all over Europe during the dawn of the Renaissance. And he was also an important statesman for the Republic of Florence, and a radical vernacularizer of chancery documents collected in the Pistolarium. But, at least in the United States, he remains relatively obscure.
Brunetto Latini translated classical rhetoricians such as Aristotle and Cicero from the Latin to vernacular Italian, though he didn't quite treat them both equally.
Here we need to go ideological. Brunetto was a member of the Guelph Party in Florence and a staunch advocate of republican democracy. Cicero, of course, had been deeply committed to republican Rome before the rise of the empire, and perhaps, next to Aristotle, he was the most important of all classical rhetoricians. Aristotle, however, especially in the Nicomachean Ethics and the Politics, had advocated empire and an emperor and downplayed the importance of a democracy. Thus, in his vernacular translations, Brunetto translated Cicero faithfully. But in fact, he mistranslated Aristotle so that he emerged as an advocate of democracy, or a democracy based on the holding of property.
This showed Latini's devotion to the Republican ideal, an ideal he spent many years in exile trying to defend. Michael, what did Latini do as a notary, ambassador, and political leader? In what sort of historical context was he situated?
Well, this was really interesting to me. In Florence during the 13th century, and even today, that figure is a very important one, deeply connected to the work of the chancery and the courts of equity. So it's not like our notion of a notary. Before and after Florence's defeat by the Ghibellines of Siena and Latini's subsequent exile to France, he attempted to work diplomatically with Siena, Florence's arch enemy.
Students, give us some more background about Latini's political career.
Latini wrote documents that were key to the forging of Republican Florence, which soon became one of the cultural capitals of Western Europe, if not the cultural capital, a center of literature, art, music, and an epicenter of political power.
At one point, Latini served as secretary for the community of Florence.
But his accomplishments in the realm of governing have overshadowed some of his poetic accomplishments, which were deeply connected to his ideas of democracy.
You recently had the opportunity to view one of the treaties Latini drafted for the feuding cities in an archive in Siena.
This was a great experience. I saw that treaty, and it reminded me when I saw it that all of Latini's work has an ideological and political edge. His most famous poem, a dream vision and pilgrimage poem entitled Il Tesoretto, was in part written to subvert aristocratic and imperial values by supplanting them with largely bourgeois values.
During Brunetto's spiritual journey, he encounters a knight who is being advised by the allegorical figure Courtesy. Let's listen.
Be sure that generosity is chief and the greatest of all my craft, so that I am worth scarcely anything. And if she does not aid me, little would I be pleasing. She is my foundation, and I her gilding and her color and enamel. And for him who speaks the truth, if we have two separate names, we are almost a single thing.
But instead of extolling chivalric values, Courtesy acquiesces to generosity, a female figure who substitutes religious imperatives for imperial ones.
But to you, beautiful friend, first of all, I say that in your speech, you should have much precaution. Do not speak too much, and think beforehand of what you would say, for the word that is said never comes back again, just like the arrow that goes and does not return.
And later, as Brunetto approaches the destination of his pilgrimage, he writes in his own voice,
O grace abounding, through which I presumed to set my eyes on the eternal light so long that I spent all my sight on it. In its profundity, I saw, ingathered and bound by love in one single volume, what in the universe seems separate, scattered, substances, accidents, and dispositions as if conjoined, in such a way that what I tell is only rudimentary.
In the end, Brunetto affiliates himself more with the Pope than the Holy Roman Emperor, as all good Guelphs would.
Michael, Dante's Divine Comedy is similar in many ways to Latini's poem El Tesoretto. What debt does Dante owe his teacher?
Well, Latini's dreamlike political allegory begins with him losing himself in a strange wood, whereas Dante loses himself in a dark wood. In each poem, a pilgrim persona undergoes a spiritual and political education, an education that can be shared with the poem's readers.
Michael, I'm so pleased that your daughter Amy, who is fluent in Italian, sends this message from Florence. Let's listen to Amy.
Hi, Dad. I'd like to read to you the first part, or the first couple of stanzas of the Inferno. Please excuse my very bad American accent. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, mi ritrovai per una selva scura, che la dritta. In the middle of the journey of our life, I came to myself within a dark wood where the straight way was lost. Ah, how hard a thing it is to tell of that wood, savage and harsh and dense, the thought of which renews my fear.
In a way, Brunetto's Il Tesoretto, or treasure, and I think that word's important to notice because it shows up in almost everything Latini writes, teaches Dante how to write his own Divine Comedy, so that the Divine Comedy can be seen as deeply intertextual with his teacher's poem. It was Brunetto who forged the generic model for Dante's poem. The famous beginning lines of the Inferno, as we heard my daughter Amy read, were borrowed nearly whole cloth from his teacher's poem, one might even say plagiarized. Intellectual property was not yet much of an issue during the dawn of the Renaissance.
In Canto 15 of the Inferno, Dante, guided by Virgil, enters the second zone of the third ring of the seventh circle of hell.
So here he is, among the Sodomites, and there Dante encounters the spirit, I put that in quotes, of Brunetto Latini, once his mentor. And upon recognizing his former student, Dante cries out,
"Are you here, Ser Brunetto?"
And later,
"With all my strength, I pray you, stay."
So even though Dante places his teacher in the seventh circle of hell, he greets him with respect and even gratitude, urging Latini to stay with him before Virgil leads him away. Clearly, Dante displays tremendous ambivalence toward his former teacher, now in hell.
In Canto 15, Dante describes the bewilderment of encountering his former teacher.
"That spirit, having stretched his arm toward me, I fixed my eyes upon his baked, brown features, so that scorching of his face could not prevent my mind from recognizing him. And lowering my face to meet his face, I answered him, 'Are you here, Ser Brunetto?' And he, 'My son, do not mind if Brunetto Latino lingers for a while with you and lets the file he's with pass on ahead.' I said, 'With all my strength, I pray you stay. And if you'd have me rest a while with you, I shall, if that please him with whom I go.' 'Oh, son,' he said, 'whoever of this flock stops but a moment, stays 100 years, and cannot shield himself when fire strikes. Therefore, move on below, but close. I'll follow. And then I shall rejoin my company, who go lamenting their eternal sorrows.'"
So, Michael, why did Dante put his old teacher in hell?
Well, it appears as though Brunetto must languish in hell because he's committed the sin of sodomy. And yet, Brunetto had children of his own. Several scholars suggest that, quote, sodomy, unquote, is a figure of speech for that which is, quote, unnatural, quote, and I deliberately put these words in quotes. These scholars focus especially on Brunetto's radical politics, on the fact that Brunetto's great Encyclopedia, Ethics, Rhetoric, Le Livre du Tresor, was written not in vernacular Italian, which Dante would have considered to be natural, but in vernacular or unnatural French. Thus, Dante's motive is not really completely clear. It is clear, though, that Dante treats Brunetto with more respect than the other figures he consigns to hell.
Scholars suggest that Dante put his teacher in hell for being a homosexual. Others suggest that this had nothing to do with it. What are the various theories?
Well, many people wonder why Dante damned the man Latini to hell, but not his most important rhetorical treatise, which appears as a treasure in paradise, in fact. That would be, again, Le Livre du Tresor. My own mentor in matters having to do with Latini, Julia Bolton Holloway, she is, by the way, the curator of the English cemetery in Florence, believes that Dante had no choice due to the religious and cultural attitudes of the time regarding homosexuality. But she shares Dante's deep respect for Brunetto's vernacular and liberatory impulses.
"We need to learn how to read Dante through the pages of Brunetto to understand what rhetoric is doing."
And most certainly, Dante respected his teacher's treasures, Il Tesoretto and Le Livre du Tresor, both aptly named, in my opinion.
Why did Julia say he had no choice?
Well, homosexuality at the time was a big negative. There are other theorists or scholars who suggest other reasons for his damnation besides the possibility that he's gay, and those reasons are really compelling. One, of course, is that he was politically unnatural because he was out there. He was pretty much a radical, and Dante was a little bit more conservative politically. But the one I like the most is that he wrote his greatest work in French, which Dante saw as unnatural. He should have been writing, after all, Le Livre du Tresor in Italian.
According to the Catholic Encyclopedia, Brunetto finds himself astray in a wood, speaks with nature in her secret places, reaches the realm of virtues, wanders into a flowery meadow of love from which he is delivered by Ovid.
Again, according to the Catholic Encyclopedia, he confesses his sins to a friar and resolves to amend his life, after which he ascends Olympus and begins to hold converse with Ptolemy.
It has recently been shown that the Tesoretto was probably dedicated to Guido Guerra, the Florentine soldier and politician who shares Brunetto's terrible fate in Dante's Inferno.
Let's hear a bit more of the canto.
If my desire were answered totally, I said to Sir Brunetto, you'd still be among, not banished from, humanity. Within my memory is fixed, and now moves me, your dear, your kind, paternal image, when, in the world above, from time to time, you taught me how man makes himself eternal. And while I live, my gratitude for that must always be apparent in my words.
According to Dante, Brunetto taught him how man makes himself eternal, presumably by making the right sort of spiritual journey in writing. But in addition, Brunetto taught his student Ciceronian rhetoric in the genre of the pilgrimage poem. He also inspired Dante to write in vernacular Italian, and this, in my opinion, ushered in an open literacy in opposition to texts in Latin, which only the privileged could read.
What many scholars tend to focus on is Dante's artistic liberty in determining the outcome of his characters. But there was more to it than that.
Artistry and craft are nearly always tethered to a background of a society's prevailing outlook on what it means to be moral, ethical, perhaps even, quote, normal, unquote.
Let's hear again from Julia Bolton Holloway.
After having already discovered Il Tesoretto of Brunetto Latino, when I was writing my doctoral thesis at Berkeley dissertation on pilgrimage in Dante, Langdon and Chaucer, to next edit the Tesoretto, which meant I travelled in Europe to all the libraries which contained manuscripts of it. There are 18 manuscripts altogether.
One of the main things I learned by talking to Julia was that she shares Dante's deep respect for Brunetto's vernacular and liberatory impulses. And most certainly Dante respected his teacher's treasures, Il Tesoretto and Le Livre du Tresor, both very aptly named.
How does Dante end the canto?
Well, the canto focuses on Latini, but of course he's interested in figuring that particular section of hell, zone of hell. So much of that canto is about Latini, actually. That's canto 15. Of course, we're in the seventh ring of hell.
Would you read it to us?
Let my tesoro, in which I still live, be precious to you, and I ask no more. And then he turned and seemed like one of those who race across the fields to win the green cloth at Verona. Of those runners, he appeared to be the winner, not the loser.
We see there that Dante portrays Latini as a runner in the Inferno.
To eternally run was the punishment Dante invented for Brunetto and his companions in the second zone of the third ring of the seventh circle of hell. You can see the elaborate architecture there. And yet, Dante deconstructs his punishment of Brunetto by declaring him to be the winner in his eternal and infernal race.
Historically, Latini's work is not well known in the United States, except for a small but devoted group of scholars.
Yeah, this was really interesting to me when I started on this pilgrimage of my own. Brunetto's life and his works are far better known in Europe than here. But a number of translators and scholars have, in fact, published about him with American presses and in scholarly journals. But in my opinion, the most important scholarship has been done by my mentor, Julia Bolton Holloway. In terms of Brunetto's contributions to writing pedagogy, hardly anything had been written save a single article published by James East in 1968. Ironically, East's article, which involved Brunetto's contributions to the teaching of letter writing, appeared in the Quarterly Journal of Speech. In contrast, Dante is routinely taught in world literature classes here in the United States, and it is usually only Dante's mention of his mentor that is noticed, if at all.
What accounts for just the lack of knowledge about him?
Well, after the book came out, it was reviewed by a friend of mine at TCU named Rich Enos, and he remarked, and I think he's right, that perhaps it was just a gap. We just didn't have that information filled in the history of rhetoric, at least as it's taught in American universities. But I think Julia says very plainly that Dante tarred Latini by putting him in hell. And even in European scholarship, he doesn't get the credit he needs to get, especially for Le Livre du Tresor, which is a brilliant work of rhetoric.
Let's talk for a moment about your own search for Latini. I know you initially worked through texts that were available electronically and in the library, but at one point you decided if this was to be a true pilgrimage, you would need to visit Florence.
I had been interested in the history of rhetoric for some time, but it had not been for my daughter, who has lived and worked in Italy for some time. My search for Latini would never have happened.
I want to thank you for your reference and support to me as your guide, both in this interview and in your book, as your Virgil. But I do need to contest that slightly. Dad, you've been my guide all through my life for so many things. And pertinent to this interview, I would say, is passing on to me your great love of literature and that becoming a true passion for me.
I felt that I needed to revision Florence, seeing it through Brunetto's eyes, and that, especially, I needed to meet face-to-face with my own mentor, Julia Bolton Holloway.
Mike, you've asked me several questions, and the first one was to tell something about my own story.
Well, as you pointed out, Brad, this book is deeply about voices, and I could not have written it at all without other very, very important voices. Holloway did brilliant archival research that my own search was completely dependent on. And her guidance throughout the project, especially during email interchanges and my dinner and interview with her at the English Cemetery, were invaluable.
I found Brunetto fascinating. When I could, after a while, I received a sabbatical, which was funded by the American Association of University Women, which gave me the chance to live in Florence for a year and to travel with the Uriel Pass from library to library, looking at all the manuscripts of Brunetto.
During that dinner, Julia prepared for both my daughter and me a wonderful leek soup and crostini, and then we retreated to her spectacular library. In that library, Julia had copies of original Latini manuscripts written in his own, as she says, lovely hand. And it really is a beautiful script to look at. I got to see again in an archive in Siena one of the treaties that he forged with Siena. And it, too, just has this lovely quality, illuminations, spectacular to look at.
Was it written as a palimpsest?
That's a really good question. I don't believe it was, but there was a good deal of interest in erasing, basically, or scraping clean parchment, especially to supplant pagan matters with Christian matters. So it was like the Christian stuff was overwritten over the pagan stuff, which is what a palimpsest basically is. I put pagan in quotes too, by the way. It was nearly uncanny browsing in Julia's library in Florence's English Cemetery, knowing that Elizabeth Barrett Browning's grave and memorial were only steps away. As my editor told me, the first part of my book provides the beef concerning Brunetto's life and significance, while the second half of my book is more of a travel narrative, a pilgrimage tale of my own.
Like a travelogue, you took digital pictures while you were in Florence. Could you talk about some of the graffiti that you found there?
The graffiti in Florence is quite different from American graffiti. It is not glib, and rarely does it have to do with sex. It seems more like the common and vernacular voice of the people, an often marginalized voice, palimpsesting or overriding voices of power and privilege. I believe, while wandering about aimlessly and translating scattered instances of graffiti, that I was somehow hearing Brunetto himself. Against and on top the received Latin corpus of the Pistolarium.
You know, my favorite part of your book is when you walk the same streets that Latini walked, but the streets have become something else.
You know, I had become hopelessly lost in the labyrinth of Florence's side streets. I was desperately trying to find a street name to match with my detailed city map, which was dangling by my side. Just then, I glanced up and beheld a memorial to Latini, a street sign bearing the name Via Brunetto Latini. I then found the street in tiny print on my torn map of Florence. I glanced up and stared for a while at a row of Pace banners hanging from the street's balconies, banners urging for peace on the very street named for the peace-loving Latini. Perfect. Or perfetto, as my daughter would say.
At one point, you go to see the memorial marking the place where Latini is buried.
Yeah, the only memorial to Brunetto that I've seen, besides Dante's ironic textual memorial to his teacher and his inclusion in a Giotto fresco with Dante at his side in the Magdalen Chapel, is a single column from his tomb, still standing in the Santa Maria Maggiore, a relatively unknown Gothic church. On the cover of Searching for Latini, there's a digital image of the obscure pillar juxtaposed with an image of the gigantic statue of Dante in front of the Santa Croce Church, one of the centers for tourism in Florence. It is moving to me that the life and work of Dante's teacher is overshadowed by the life and work of the student. And this is my opinion, but I believe that all teachers of writing most desire the work of their students to surpass and overshadow their own writing.
Many people don't realize this, but even in certain documents written by our founding fathers, we can see rhetorical turns of phrase that seem almost directly gathered from Latini's work.
In the future, I may try to investigate, with Julia's help, other documents that lead her to believe that Brunetto's civic writing was both pioneering and deeply influential, even for the founders of our country. She claimed that his work with constitutional documents was so very intertextual with our own Constitution and even our Declaration of Independence. And declarations for the Commune of Florence were incredibly important, and Brunetto authored many of these declarations, which were read to the sound of bells in a public forum. Just a wonderful image, isn't it?
Michael, you say at the end of writing your book that it's been a pilgrim's tale, but it urges you to see it as an odyssey. Whereas Dante's dream journey ended at a point other than his point of departure, as did Latini's, you find yourself back where you started, in Little Rock. What did your search teach you?
My final chapter is titled Homecoming and an Open Book. I try to explain there that learning and writing about Latini, about Brunetto, has helped me to understand better what it is I hope to accomplish during the last years of my life as a teacher of writing.
So could you read a little from your book?
Sure. I'll read just this single passage that is near the very end of my book. In order to teach writing, I must become a student again, and I must palimpsest my own teaching on the texts, the voices of others who have been forces of resistance and of open discourse. My search for Latini has provided me with both energy and reassurance. There have been other teachers who have endeavored to write books that do not close down discourse, but that open it up. Latini wrote such books. Julia Bolton Holloway has written such books. My former student, Matthew Abraham, is now writing such books. For myself, and perhaps for all of us who teach writing, the implication seems strong. The writing teacher might be a force of what I want to call, at last, the open book. And that passage, I think, gets at one of the main tenets of my book. Like Brunetto, I am obscure. But I hope that I will teach in such a way that my students will transcend what they are taught and that I might be open to learning from my students, which is often the case. Thus, marginalized voices are heard in texts, and I hope that my students might use rhetoric to achieve not only persuasive effectiveness, but also ethical and authentic purposes.
So, students of Brunetto Latini, where does this leave us? Why should we care about Brunetto Latini?
Because he has great rhetorical advice to offer about writing.
Because he was an advocate of decidedly liberatory pedagogy.
Because he deconstructed master discourses and opened up the floor to voices that might have been silenced otherwise.
Yes, voices of resistance, voices of the people.
In closing, then, I asked you, Michael, the same question Andrea Herman, your colleague and friend, asked you at the end of your book. She said, "But I still don't see why we should know about Latini when, in fact, we already know about the importance of literacy, giving voice to those who are on the margins of power, who are even oppressed."
In the book I write, I was stumped. I had been trying to assert the potential importance of Latini to American rhetoricians and teachers of writing, but I had not yet gotten to his unique relevance to what we are trying to do in the here and now. Frustrated, I sputtered out, "It is the searching that matters. It is the searching for others who, like Latini, help us understand what we are trying to do when we teach writing."
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Also, check out the supplementary material posted there. Special thanks to Latini scholar Julia Bolton Holloway and to Amy Klein, Mr. Frank Thurmond, who contributed the readings and Italian guitar music, as well as Dr. Jeremy Ecke, Heather Hummel, and Chris Hickey, who supplied their voices. Thank you to Lauren and Micah Sukani for the music. A big shout out to producer extraordinaire, the incomparable Chris Hickey. And thank you, Dr. Michael Klein, from UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, for taking us along on this search for Brunetta Latini. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, hoping in the words of Latini that your desire and will for your own searches were moved already by love that moves the sun and the other stars.